Good morning. Welcome. So this is your first time here, or if you haven't been with us in a while, we started a new sermon series, and it actually goes in line with a new chapter we're beginning here at our church. For those of you, again, who haven't been here for a long time or visiting, we had a previous pastor here for about 10 years, and then he went on to down in the Phoenix area last fall to launch a new ministry, and we had a couple months of transition, and then at the first of the year, I stepped in as the pastor. And so along with that, we've started a new sermon series called Knowing God. And the idea behind is this, is that we embark on a new journey as a church and a new direction, that the place we must start is not with ourselves, but with God. We must start with who He is and what He's about to understand ourselves as a church and what our mission is about and who we are. And so that's what we're doing. We're starting with God, and we're finding our identity and who we are and our mission in Him, and then later talking about what kind of church that means for us to be. So last week, we looked at the love of God to find out what kind of church we should be, that we should be. And this week, we're looking at the truth of God, the truth of God, and grounding ourselves in His truth to understand to be a church of truth and to follow the God who is truth. Before we do that, though, I think it's important at the very outset to define even what is truth. What is truth? And that's the very question, actually, that Pontius Pilate asked Jesus. If you remember in the book of John in chapter 18, as Jesus was on trial, and Jesus said to Pontius Pilate, he came to testify the truth. And Pontius Pilate responded by saying, what is truth? And so that's the question, what is truth? And here's how I would define it. Truth is reality as it is, not as we perceive it to be, think it should be, or want it to be. Truth is reality as it is, not as we perceive it to be, think it should be, or want it to be. Reminds me a little bit of my two daughters and getting ready for bed at night. And then I look at the clock, and it says it's 7 to 7:30, and I tell them, hey, guys, time to get into bed. And they say, Dad, no, it's like 5 o'clock. We've got like 3 hours left. And I'm like, that's really odd. The clock says 7:30. Nope, the clock is wrong. We've got like 2 hours. So it's not what you want it to be or think it should be or perceive it to be. It's what reality actually is. And everyone's searching for this ultimate truth, right? I mean, is that not one of the deepest drives of the human person to figure out what ultimately is truth? And people search for it night and day. And they do it in all different kinds of ways. Some people actually reject the idea of absolute truth altogether. There is no such thing as absolute truth. Other people speculate on what truth is. They observe things in their life. They observe things around in the world. They take bits and pieces of different things that they've learned from books or media or films, that kind of things, and they piece together and speculate what ultimately truth is. Some people turn to science, and of course, we're not talking about truth in regards to mathematics or technology or those kinds of things. Those things science certainly deals with. But sometimes people turn to science for other things around moral values and world views and those kinds of things. Some people turn to psychology to understand the mind and how the mind works and chemicals and the body and the brain to understand truth. Some people see finding truth as you have to experience it. You have to go out and experience every single thing in life to understand if it's true. It's kind of like the buffet line at a restaurant, right? You just take a spoonful of everything, put it on your plate and try it, and you'll discover what's true. But I think there's actually another alternative besides those, that we discern truth not by a speculation, but by revelation. Revelation. That in fact, that man's pursuit is not so much of truth or trying to find truth, but a truth being revealed to man. And in fact, that's exactly what the Bible claims, is that truth is not so much something to be pursued, but God revealing it to us. Because God does not want us to spend our entire lives speculating and guessing and assuming and experiencing all these kinds of things, trying to figure out truth, when it comes, in fact, that He has revealed what it is. And in the Bible, in John 14:6, one of the most radical verses in the entire Bible, which many of you have heard of, Jesus says to those around Him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through Me.
And this statement is so staggering, so radical, because no other person in history has ever said that. Of all the other religions in the world, many of them claim to say things like, follow me to this way of truth, or I can show you a new understanding of truth, or a new idea of truth. But no one ever said the claim, I am truth. That is an altogether different claim, and yet Jesus makes it and says, in fact, that he is truth. What's important to understand here is that Jesus isn't saying that God speaks the truth or that he just tells us the truth, which he does, but in fact, he is saying where truth comes from. Its very beginning, its origin, its genesis, its source. Truth is not some concept that floats around in the sky out there somewhere that we have to grab. Truth is, in fact, a person, someone you can know. It is God himself. God himself is truth. And then out of that, all truth flows. It is not a concept or idea. It is a person, and all truth comes flowing out of God. It means that he is the measure, the standard of truth, and what he says is ultimate truth. And the opposite is true. What he does not say and what he does not do is false. A couple other verses on this. James 1:13 says, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. Notice it didn't say God chooses not to be tempted. He cannot even be tempted because he's what? He's truth. Another verse, 1 John 1:15 says, this is the message we have heard from him and declare to you. God is light, in him there is no darkness at all. If we claim to have fellowship with him yet walk in darkness, we lie and do not live by the truth. There's no darkness in him at all. It doesn't even exist because he's truth. 1 John 5:20 says, we also know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we may know him who is true. Him who is true. So what does this mean, though? The fact that God is truth, that he is the ultimate source, the origin, the genesis of truth. I think it means a number of things, but I want to highlight three today. The first is this. He determines what's true and what's not true. He determines what's true and what's not true. A good friend of mine named Brandon Sawaya up in the Bellingham area, when he graduated from college, he decided to go up to Canada and work for this youth group. And what they did is that he would lead these hiking tours up in Canada. And so all summer long, he'd be up there leading about 5 to 10 kids on these backpacking trips that were up in the mountains and going across all these different areas. And he told me about one time when he had a group of about 5 to 10 kids, and they went on their journey. And he had a route that he would pretty much take every single time. So he knew this route that he'd marked out that he would go. And so he went with these 5 to 10 kids, and it's up in an area where there's a lot of snow and it's cold, of course. And he's going along with this group, and about 3 days into it, he wakes up one morning, and there's tremendous fog. There's this fog everywhere, and then it starts snowing. And he's like, oh no, this is gonna be bad. And so he takes the kids throughout the day and journeys along the route that he thought was the route to be taking. So he continued on that. And then he got to a place at night, and he's like, okay, you know, we're going to have to camp here. And of course, the kids are asking him, hey, how's it going? Are we heading the right area? And he's like, you bet we are. You bet we are. And inside, he's like, I'm not sure we're going the right way. And so they camp out that night, and he wakes up in the morning, and again, it's total fog, total whiteout, and he's now getting pretty scared. He's like, I think we're probably lost. I don't really have a clue where we're actually at. He was looking for markers, too, if he could see, you know, as he was going, and he couldn't see the markers. And he was thinking, oh, my gosh, I think we're lost. And so he wakes up, and he gets up, and he opens up his tent at the beginning of it and looks out, and there's this one small kind of peak hole that you could see through the sky, and you could see this one spot, and he could see the edge of this cliff or this ridge that had these rocks that he knew that he'd seen before. And in his route, he knew that was one of the markers. There was this ridge part, and the rocks were angled in a way where he knew that was a mark. And at first, it was a total miracle. The fact of the one, you know, kind of hole he can see through is exactly this ridge, which is a miracle in the first place. Secondly, soon as he saw that, he was like, that's it. Now I can orient myself the whole rest of the trip. this will be the reference point from which then I can guide this group of boys back to the place. I know where we're going. I know where we shouldn't be going. I know how to get there. I know how to navigate the whole thing because he had a reference point. And the same is true with God. When he is the ultimate truth and he defines truth, he becomes the reference point. And once you have a reference point, that allows you to understand and navigate the rest of life because you have a fixed point. The thing is, you know, the truth is, though, we live in a day and a culture where people no longer believe in a fixed reference point. And this is, of course, nothing new, I think, to any of us. Truth has become, as you well know, relative. It's become personal. It's become experiential. It's become fluid and based on circumstance. It's funny because I think the culture thinks that there is no absolute truth or no reference point or no place that they fix a stake to determine what's true. And that is true on one hand, but on the other hand, in fact, there actually is a reference point they have. And that's myself. I am the fixed reference point. And I determine what is true. And out of my determination of what's true, I then gauge what I want to do with life. No longer is it based on being outside of time and space, but it's based on the human person themselves. The human has become the ultimate reference point. This is where our current culture is, right? I mean, you see it in films, you see it in books, you see it in media, you see it at your work, you see it at the schools, you see it everywhere. The idea of a relative truth. And there's a couple issues with this, I think, is when you make the human person the center of truth, you run into a couple problems. One is that truth becomes not a pursuit for what's actually real, but a world where I remain in control. Pursuing the truth really becomes about pursuing my own interests, my own desires, and the kind of world that I want. That's really what it becomes. It also becomes, I no longer align my life to the truth, I align the truth to my life. I no longer align my life to the truth, I align the truth to my life. The way I want to live, the values I hold, the beliefs I have, the way I want to organize and structure my life, that becomes the reference point. And then I organize all truth and life around that. There's a professor on the East Coast at a university over there named Thomas Nagel. He's a well-known professor. He's a philosopher. And he was asked by someone about this, about his lack of believing in an absolute truth. And his response was this: I speak from experience, being strongly subject to this fear myself. I want atheism to be true, and I'm made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. I have to commend him that he, in fact, was honest. That's a very honest response. And it reveals what's really behind it. It wasn't really a pursuit for truth. It was a pursuit for a world that would line up to how I want it to be. And it's interesting because you find this exact thing 3,000 years ago in the book of Judges. If you've read the book of Judges, it basically follows the book of Joshua in the Bible when the Israelites had just been rescued and they're in this process in Joshua of conquering all these nations in Canaan and in the Promised Land. And then we get to the point of Judges where they've conquered some lands but not others. But God begins to institute these judges or leaders essentially to lead the people. And it's really interesting if you look at the whole book and the progression of these judges. And they start off with a pretty good solid people. They have pretty good character. They make pretty good choices. They know between right and wrong. They want to follow God. And then every time they die and a new judge comes, it's someone who's a little more corrupt, someone who's willing to make a compromise in a certain area, someone who's not quite committed to God. And you see this progression throughout the whole book. Every time there's a new judge, it always goes down a level. And by the end of the Judges, you get to Samson, who's the most godless guy in the world, who's driven by his desires, this ungodly man who's totally corrupt. And then the last like four chapters of Judges, there is no longer a judge. And it's very interesting because in that, you find a phrase that gets repeated over and over and over again. And that phrase is this: In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That phrase is repeated over and over. And in fact, this is important. The very last verse of the book of Judges is that verse. 21 chapters. And the last word it ends on is, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And if you have read the book of Judges, the last four chapters of the book of Judges are about the most darkest and disturbing chapters in the Bible. There is some ugly, wicked stuff that happens in those four chapters. And it's because everyone did what was right in his own eyes. No longer was truth defined by what God said or by putting him as a fixed point, but by humanity. It's also really interesting, though, because if you look back at the beginning of Judges, there's also another phrase that gets used a lot in there. In fact, it gets used more than eight times in Judges 2 and Judges 3, 4, 6, 1, 10, 6, and 13, 1. I'm sure you're going to have those all down by memory. And in all of those, another very interesting phrase is used, and this is the phrase. Every time a judge would die, the next chapter started with this: again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And you know, I think for a long time, I just kind of went right over that and said, yep, they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. But it's so interesting when you recognize the contrast between the eyes was right of them and the eyes of the Lord. Look at what evil is defined by. It's not defined by some random concept. It's defined by eyes of the Lord. It's in reference to God. Meaning God's the fixed point. Anything other than him is evil. He is the one who's the fixed reference point. It is God who determines what's true in our world. It is God who says what is right and wrong. It is God who says what you should do with your life. And this does two things, I think. I think it does this first thing. It anchors your life. It anchors your life. Do you ever seen that movie Gravity with Sandra Bullock? It came out about a couple years ago. That movie where they went up in that rocket ship up into space with Georgia Clooney as well. And they were in this ship, and Sandra Bullock was tied to this cord that basically anchored her to the ship. And at some point when they ran into something and the rocket started spinning around, her cord got severed, and you just see this picture of her just flying off into space, just floating and going off into just nothingness. And I thought, you know, that really characterizes a life without God at the center. You are a boat out on the water that is just tossed back and forth. Wherever the wind goes, wherever the waves goes, is wherever your life is gonna go. Wherever the culture goes is where you're going. But when you've got God as a fixed point, he is the anchor. He anchors you down to a firm foundation. The second is, it gives you a decision-making tool. When God's a fixed reference point, it allows you to make decisions, godly decisions about life. As you look at all those different questions you face about, you know, how to date and who the person is that you should marry and the kind of person that you should marry, the way you should handle your finances and how you handle debt, what relationships you have, what relationships you don't have, the friends you keep, the friends you shouldn't keep, the kind of movies you watch, the TV shows you watch, all those kinds of things, having God as a fixed reference point gives you a decision tool. You can look at those things and assess those things and determine what would be a godly way to handle those things. Versus just not having that and determining whatever's right for me, whatever I want to do, where I'm driven by my desires, by friends, whatever else it is. It gives me a way to make decisions, a decision tool. Could you say that the choices you make today are defined by God's truth? Where are you unwilling to obey God's truth because it conflicts with how you want to live? Where are you unwilling to go because your lifestyle is a certain way and you don't want to go a different one? The second thing about this, when God's truth is the absolute truth, it's that his truth is constant. His truth is constant. Made me think about my wife and I recently, about 4 or 5 months ago, got to go out for a date. My daughters are over at her parents' house, and so went out for Thai food. Our kids don't like, you know, Thai food a lot, so whenever they're away, we're like, awesome, chance to go for Thai food. So we go out for Thai food down south, and we go eat, and great time. And then we get out in the car afterwards, and my wife looks at me and she says, you know, that's it. She says, I am not going out to Taifu with you anymore. And I'm like, what? And she's like, no, I am not doing this. She's like, every time you go out Taifu, you always get the like only two things. All you want, you know, is pad thai or cashew chicken. She's like, that's all you ever want. And she's like, I'm so tired of it, you know? She's like, when I was growing up, when my family went out for Thai food, everybody got like four or five dishes. We always tried new things. And she's like, all you wanted those two, you know, same exact things every time. And I'm like, hey, if I find something really good at the restaurant and I can be guaranteed it's going to be good, I'm getting that. And she's like, this is not fun. And she's like, second of all, she's like, you in restaurants. She's like, you only have like four or five restaurants. That's all you ever want to go to. You know, I know probably some of you couples are like, yep, like we got the same thing in my house. Right? You know? And so she's like, it's just, you're doing the same thing every time. And I thought, yes, I am constant. I am constant. So although in the food department, that may not be good, in the truth department, that is really good. And Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8 says this, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. He is constant. He does not change. The same yesterday, today, and forever. And his truth being constant gives me a firm foundation to stand on no matter what I'm going through. That's the big thing. Having him as that constant, that truth is there, it's the same no matter what the circumstances are in my life, no matter what I'm going through. And the reality is if truth is not in God and it's in me, then it's always shifting. It's always changing depending on my mood or my feelings or the issues in my family or at school or with my friends. And then depending on my beliefs are shifting and changing, it's always changing. And that produces anxiety and worry and fear, uneasiness, uncertainty, doubt, reluctance in a person. And you may be coming here today and feeling those exact same things. That might describe your life, a life just marked by worry and fear and uncertainty, and it's always up in the air. But when I put God as the truth and he become constant, I can live with boldness and courage and confidence, right? As no matter what I face, he is under and in all of it. And you really see this in Jesus' life. A couple quick examples. In Luke 4, when Jesus begins his ministry and he's tempted in the desert, Satan comes to him and tempts him three different times and gives him these great options of things to do. And every single time, Jesus responds the exact same thing. God's truth and that God is constant. No, I'm not going to do that, and here's why. And he always appeals to God's word. He's constant no matter what Satan tries to throw at him. In Matthew 26, in the garden, when Jesus, right before the day he's going to be crucified, and as he's going with the disciples, and he's overwhelmed with sorrow, he's actually bleeding, sweat on his head. And he goes out in the garden, he lays down, and he begins to talk to God, and he says, Father, take this cup from me. I don't want to have to go through this. Take this cup from me. But follows it right up with, not my will be done, but your will be done. Because he's constant. It's God's truth. And lastly, in John 18, before Pontius Pilate, when Jesus is standing before Pilate on trial, and he's standing there and Jesus talks about his ministry, and then Pilate asks him a bunch of questions and Jesus doesn't say anything. And Pilate looks at him and says, don't you understand? Don't you know I have power over you to either kill you or keep you alive? Do you not understand that? And Jesus looks at this man who has the ability to execute him. And Jesus says, in my paraphrase, don't you understand? God has power over you. You wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for him. He's constant. He's not even swayed by Pontius Pilate. And it's all because he always operated by the Father's truth, even though the circumstances around him were all over the place. And he probably was wrestling with all different kinds of emotions and issues, and yet he always remained constant. You know, some of us have been here a lot longer than I have here on earth, but we live in an interesting time period right now. And I think if you could use one word to describe our time period, it is filled with change. Things like our recent election, the race relations going on right now, ISIS and terrorism, the loss of absolute truth. Many people's lives right now, all around you, in your workplace, in your neighborhoods, in your schools, are marked by fear, anxiety, worry, a lack of hope because of everything they see around them. They look at the culture, they look at what's happening, they look at politics, they look at all those things, and they look at all those things and are overwhelmed with this anxiety about what's going to happen. Not so with the Christian. Not so with the Christian. The Christian looks at this, and they can see that below, above, and in between all the media, the rhetoric, the ideas, the opinions, the events that are swirling around all of us, God is unmoved and unswerved by it all. He continues marching forward with his plan. His truth remains the exact same, no matter what happens. And he invites us to live in that truth and then be people who go out into our world with the opposite. In fact, we are bold. We are courageous. We are firm. We are all the things that they're not. We're not filled with fear. We're not filled with anxiety. We're not filled with worry. We're filled with hope for what God will do in the middle of this because we live by an unchanging truth. Where in your life right now are you giving into fear, anxiety, worry, and doubt? Is it because perhaps that God is not at the core of your life? That in fact, maybe he is, but you've given yourself over to worry and anxiety and other kinds of fears? Where do you need to remember God's constancy and truth and build your identity on that? Okay, the last one is this. When God is our truth, we can trust him. We can trust him. Have you ever discovered the formula, truth builds trust? Truth builds trust. I want to challenge you, think about a person right now that you trust a lot. Just take a minute, and I'm sure you can picture someone in your head that you trust a lot. And I guarantee that person that you have in your mind right now has spoken to you things that are true. In fact, that might be one of the things, the most, or one of the dominant characteristics of that person, that they're truthful. Then I also want you to think about a person that you don't trust. And as you have that person in your mind, I almost guarantee they've either lied to you or misled you in some way. Because truth builds trust. Truth builds trust. I think one of the issues, though, we have with this, with our ability to trust God, to trust his word, to trust that he is telling us the truth, and to actually trust him, and to fully believe what he tells us, and then to do it and to follow him, and to live our lives like that, how he defines truth, is that I think more often than not, our lifestyles shape our beliefs rather than our beliefs shape our lifestyles. Our lifestyles shape our beliefs rather than our beliefs shape our lifestyles. Yeah, many of you know that prior to being the pastor here, I worked for the city of Bellevue. And it was in the fall last year when I let my supervisor know that I'd be leaving. And I talked to a number of you about that transition that I know. And one of the things that was really important to me, a major value I had, was leaving well. I had experienced a number of people at work who did not leave well, left on very poor choices, kind of just left and were like, whatever, you guys just pick up all the junk. And I was like, you know, here I've lived, you know, or worked with these people for 12 plus years. They know I'm a follower of Christ. They know I want to be a pastor. I want to leave on a really strong note. And it was a huge value to me. And so I told my supervisor that I'd be leaving. I said, you know, I'm giving 110% every day from this day forward until I leave. And so we hired someone to take my place. And about a month and a half into this, as I was in there, I remember driving home from work one day, had kind of a tough day, was tired. And I started thinking, you know, maybe it wouldn't be that big a deal if I didn't leave strong. You know, I was like, you know, maybe I don't get a couple things done. Maybe I'm sick a couple days. You know, is it that big a deal? A couple years from now, no one's even going to, you know, remember me. It won't even matter a lot. And I saw over the next month, there were so many days I woke up really tired, like, yeah, probably not that big a deal to finish well. It's going to be all right. I'm going to move on to this pastor thing. It'll be cool. And it had dawned on me that very thing. I thought, wait a second. My lifestyle's determining my beliefs, not my beliefs determining my lifestyle. And we let that happen all the time. I wind up having the lifestyle I have and the way that I want to live, and my beliefs get formed around that, rather than my beliefs and God's truth shaping my life and how I structure it in living. But because God is the truth, we can trust what he says. We can trust what he says in here. In fact, we have to give up our lifestyles to know the real truth about God and his ways and how he wants us to live. And in Psalm 119, 41 through 48, I want to give an example of a couple passages here about God's truth and trusting. Psalm 119, 41 through 48. The author says, "May your unfailing love come to me, O Lord, your salvation according to your promise. Then I will answer the one who taunts me, for I trust in your word. Do not snatch the word of truth from my mouth, for I have put my hope in your laws." And then notice his courage. "I will always obey your law forever and ever. I will walk about in freedom, for I have sought out your precepts. I will speak of your statutes before kings and will not be put to shame. For I delight in your commands because I love them. I lift up my hands to your commands, which I love, and meditate on your decrees. For I trust in your word. I've put my hope in your laws." And in Proverbs 3, 5 through 6, one of my favorite verses in the entire Bible, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight." This radical place of trust. Because why? Because he's truthful. Because he's truthful. And here's the thing, you guys. We can trust what he says about us in both the positive and negative. And what I mean is this, is that sometimes I think God's truth to us, God's truth about who he says you are, is sometimes both really hard to hear and sometimes really easy to hear. And it's negative in this, is that when you think of yourself as a good person, when you think of yourself as a good person not really in need of God, God's truth is coming to you negative. It's going to come to you to hurt. Because in Romans 3, 9 through 20, I want to read you this. This is what God says about us, about our true condition before him. Paul says, "What shall we conclude then? Are we any better? Not at all. We have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands God, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways, and the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin." Harsh words, harsh words. But like a doctor who tells a patient the real condition of their illness, in the same way, God speaks the truth to you about the real condition of your heart. And the person, I think, who comes before God and says they're a good person, God looks in them and says, "You're not. In fact, you're a very wicked person, a very self-centered person, and you need a savior." And for you today, if that's you, that is God's word of truth to you. His gift to you to understand the truth of who you really are. On the flip side, some of us come with the opposite idea. In fact, that my life is worthless. My life has no value. My life has no meaning or purpose or anything of that nature. And God comes in a very different way. God comes to that person and says, your life is valuable beyond belief. I love you with no strings attached. If you were here last Sunday, the message about God's love, the ultimate message was he loves you with no strings attached. There's nothing you need to do or clean up or change in order to do that. He loves you right where you are. He loved us so much, in fact, that he sent his own very son to die for us, to take our place so that we might be righteous. And even if people in our home or in our work or in your school or in your neighborhood think that you're worthless, you're meaningless, you don't matter, you're ugly, you'll never amount to anything, God says you're precious, you're beautiful. You have infinite worth, and he calls you a son or a daughter. You can trust what he says about you because he is the truth, and he only speaks the truth. Do you trust God? And I know it's kind of a cliche, you hear it so often today, but do you actually trust him? If you thought about your life right now, if you thought about the way that you do your marriage or you do your finances, your relationships, or the way that you just think about your life, do you trust him? Do you actually trust him? And if people looked at your life, could they really say that person trusts God? They don't have a backup plan. They actually trust him. Do you trust God? How many of you have heard of a tuning fork? Yeah, I think some of us have. I make no claim to be someone who's into music. Well, I should take that back. I love music. I am not someone who's musical. I think I said last time, I'm the last person you want singing some songs up there. But it was interesting. I've heard about a tuning fork, but never knew exactly what a tuning fork does. And so for those of you who don't know, a tuning fork, I was trying to get one today but couldn't. It's that device you hold here and it has those two prongs that go up on the side. And what you do, basically, if you have an instrument like a guitar or another instrument or a piano, and you want to tune it, you use a tuning fork. And now today, of course, they have other options that you can actually have an app on your phone that does it. Or we have back here, we have an instrument right here that our worship team uses that you can do the exact same thing. We'll see if it works here. Right there? Okay. So it makes a noise, and a tuning fork, what you do is you bump it against an object, and the tuning fork begins to move back and forth, and you give it a second because there's some high and low tones that need to drown out. But once they do, it then establishes basically a perfect pitch or a perfect tone. And then what you do once you have that noise, which is really hard to hear, is then you take your instrument like you're a piano, and then you hit the A tune. Again, I'm not musical, but you hit the A. And what it'll do is it matches up against the tuning fork, and you can tell if the sound is exactly right or a little bit off or really off. And the more it's off, the more then you have to tune that instrument. So if it was a piano and a person came, they would use a tuning fork, and they would hit A, and they'd have the tuning fork going, and they could measure and be like, whoa, that's way off. They would either loosen the strings or tighten the strings to be able to then tune up the piano. So you take the piano, and you tune it to the fork. The fork is the measure. The fork's the standard. And you determine how out of tune or out of pitch everything is else based off the tuning fork. It is the standard from which all other pitches and tones are measured against. God is that tuning fork. Everything else is measured up against him. So I want to ask you today, the question really isn't, what is truth to you? The question is, will you tune your life to the tuning fork? Will you pray with me? Lord, you are absolute truth. You are absolute truth, God. Let us today worship you, Father, for the incredible truth you are. And I think the more that we put ourselves or put our lives before you, we realize, if we're honest, the places of untruth in our lives, the places where we've bought into lies or we've bought into the ways that we've wanted to organize our life or structure our life. Not realizing, Father, that in fact you say in your word that the truth sets us free. that truth sets us free from deceptions that we believe or lies or idols we worship, that your truth sets us free. God, let us be a church and a people that are marked by your truth. We are surrounded by a culture, Father, that chooses not to go that way, to have a truth that only resides in them and is defined by them. Let us be different, Father. Let us put ourselves under you and in your truth and recognize that we will not compromise, because your truth really is it. It is actually what is real. It is what we can line our lives up against, Father, so that we might live lives to your glory. You want us to live lives that are abundant, that are beautiful, that are joyful and good, but it only comes about when we line our lives up with your truth. I pray, God, that we would never become a wayward people, a wayward church that walks away from your truth, that we would always align everything we do and say up to your truth as the standard. Help us, God, to live lives of truth. Help us to be people of truth, that we speak the truth to our family members and our coworkers and our neighbors. We do it in a way that's wrapped with grace and with love and with kindness and generosity, but it's still the truth. And we will not compromise on the truth. God, we pray you speak truth into our lives today. For those of us who come here and, Father, we think something different of ourselves, I pray to humble the person, God, who needs to be humbled. And they might have open ears to hear you say to them, I love you so much, I want to know the truth about your life and how it falls short of what I designed for you. And that I want to forgive you, that I've gone to the cross for you, that I've opened up a new way for you to live. You only have to accept that. And the person today, Lord, who is here, who thinks nothing of their life, who's been so discouraged, who inside is struggling to have any sense of identity, God, that you would just bathe over them words of love and encouragement, of hope, of meaning, of purpose, to know they have infinite worth before you and to know that your words are true. Thank you, Father, that you are the God of truth and that we put ourselves and center ourselves in you as the God of truth. We love you, Jesus. In your name, amen.